VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk. Times Plus Live Comedy at Wilton's. This month's Times Plus Live Comedy at Wilton's brings you four not-to-be-missed acts at the beautiful Wilton's Music Hall in East London. Appearing will be Ed Axel, Nina Conti and Andy Zaltzman, all compared by resident MC Jared Christmas. It takes place on Thursday, 26th of January 2012 at 7:30 p.m. For tickets, call 0871 620 4025 or book online at timestickets.co.uk.
Welcome to the game. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I'm tasked with fitting a sensational weekend of football into the next 40 minutes or so. Helping me to do this week will be Pedro Pinto. You know him from CNN's World Sport, James Ducker in the Great Northwest, and of course, Tony Cascarino. It's Manchester v. London this weekend, or at least North London. We're going to start at Eastlands, and I thought this game was potentially, we might look back at this as a turning point. It could be where possibly Tottenham get knocked out of the title hunt, and where Manchester City sort of get out of a difficult situation in a game which could have taken a very, very different turn. But let's start with the big incident, the one which, because it upset Harry Redknapp, and we in the media all love him. Mario Balotelli on Scott Parker, the logic being Balotelli kicks out at Parker, should have been sent off. Howard Webb doesn't see it because he turns his head to look in the other direction at the wrong time. And Balotelli then wins and converts the winning penalty. Don't want to turn this into a Webb assassination. We've assassinated enough times. So let's resuscitate him, keep him alive. But Cass, should Webb have spotted it and should Balotelli have gone?
Well, spotting an incident for a referee is tricky at times.
Especially when it's right in front of you.
Well, no, he's looking to the right. He's looking to the right. And then he glances back. Well, he's obviously looking at something that's happened on the other side of the right-hand side of the pitch.
But what? Godot showed up?
Gab, he's...
Okay.
The referee's got to have eyes everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is, for me, is that I think he sneakily gets maybe out the corner of her eye, but he's not sure of the intention that Balotelli has made. Because I straight away thought he's deliberately done that. Deliberately with a pretty venomous way of... Because he stamps down hard, and he knows the ball's not there.
You said stamp down. Can we just get a clear down dynamic? Because it looked to me like it was more of a kickback, a back heel.
Yeah.
And then we can debate whether he knew Parker's head was there. But I want to ask you, if he hadn't connected with Parker's head, would you still have sent him off?
Well, it's very difficult because it's like, if you need to see blood to send people off in a challenge. If you see an elbow and a player's holding his nose, you immediately think, well, that's right. That's very, very difficult to assess. What I would say is that the intention was there. It was definitely obvious, and it was obvious he caught his head.
But because the intention is there, we should send him off even if he doesn't connect.
When he doesn't connect, it doesn't... how many times... If you're going to send players off for challenges and they don't connect, nine times out of ten, people are going to be scratching their head saying, well, he hasn't even caught him. Why? There is intention nearly in every tackle. I don't say to hurt, but there's intention to make
a tackle. We're not talking about a tackle here. We're talking about somebody kicking out at somebody's head.
Well, I thought the intention was there straight away. I immediately thought he's a lucky boy.
If there was intent to kick him in the head, then it shouldn't make it matter. It shouldn't matter whether he connects with his head or not.
Well, Howard Webb, and we're talking about a split decision.
No, I'm not blaming Webb, but I just want to get from you.
Absolutely. Okay. It's obvious. It's obvious he's there. The intention was there. So, yes, he should be sent off whether he connected or not.
I'll take Tony's opinion. I'll take Tony's opinion on this because he played professionally. I'm not 100% convinced that Balotelli wanted to hurt Parker because he was out of balance and he was wanting to put his foot down.
He also had Modric hanging off him.
I have seen Balotelli be probably one of the most controversial players in this generation, for sure. I don't personally encourage the kind of attitude he has on the pitch ever. I'm not a big fan. On this occasion, I'm not 100% convinced he actually meant to hurt Parker, and it's a different situation. For example, with what happened with Pep and Messi in the first leg of the quarterfinals of the Spanish Cup, that was no doubt looking down, stamping. This is, I don't really know where this guy is. I'm falling down. I'm going to put my foot down. Maybe there was intent, and I'll take Tony's lead on it because he knows what it's like in situations like that.
I just think it's vaguely comical that anyone could even suggest that there was no intent there. I mean, the first leg comes down.
You're vaguely comical, Pedro.
I just think, you know, he thrusts his foot down. Now, whether he knows Parker's there or not, doesn't matter. I mean, there's clear intent to thrust your foot down. Whether he connects or not, why is he kind of reacting and behaving like that?
Well, he has just been. Sometimes you see players who just get tackled by two opponents and they sort of flail out afterward. I mean, I'm not saying it's right, but and might well be punishable with a red card. But it's not something outrageous and beyond the pale. It's a reaction foul, right?
I don't know. It just happens too often with Balotelli.
Well, you follow City more closely than I do. Maybe you can recount a list of incidents in the head.
There was a Malumbu incident against West Brom, which I don't think was as bad as the one yesterday. It was kind of a kick out. City challenged it. He actually got sent off the incident. City challenged it, but it was upheld. He had and obviously another incident against Dynamo Kiev.
Last year
when he was sent off for that.
But you're just listing his red cards, and as I recall, that was very different. That was a high boot, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, it was. But I'm just saying is that he's got.
Well, he gets sent off a lot.
Yeah, no, he gets sent off for kind of petulant, kind of silly, kind of action.
Like Paul Scholes.
I don't know if it's just that he can't tackle, or right. that he's just there's a streak of malice in him.
As a game, I thought it was compelling. I don't think it was the greatest game I've ever seen, but there was one moment of I thought, sheer beauty. And I want to talk a little bit about the evolution of Gareth Bale, because, we think of him as a left-back, we thought of him as a left-sided midfielder. Now he plays on the right, he plays on the middle. He's becoming almost the number 10 on this team. And that strike was fantastic, and also the pass that set up Defoe, the chance that he missed. Could you have seen this evolution coming, Pedro?
No, I thought always he was very fast. I thought always he would cause a lot of problems in that way, similar to an Aaron Lennon, perhaps. But he's developed his skill and his talent immensely. I think that it would be ill-advised to move him into the middle, just because you would take away from him the space he needs to shine. Similar to Cristiano Ronaldo, when he comes through to the middle, he has less space. He's phenomenal. He is phenomenal. He's really one of the best left-sided players in the world right now.
And he plays on the right often.
Yes, but keep him on the wings. I just hope he keeps on the wings, because that's where he... I mean, I remember one Champions League game last season where he just ran by Maicon like he wasn't even there. It was the guy is getting better and better.
He's probably got half a yard quicker than Ronaldo. I think he's just got a slight edge on Ronaldo, especially at distance. And the Norwich game was just unbelievable. That's for me. He played, and you mentioned Ronaldo. I don't think there's any better comparison, because he just played in every position and was just causing mayhem.
Let's give Ducker the easy question, which will in no way alienate either red fans or blue fans in Manchester. Is Bale better than Rooney right now?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think Bale is... I think he's a potential to be a more kind of explosive match winner than Rooney on a more regular basis.
James, I just had one thing that just only bothers me about Bale, and it's not Bale the player. It's I'm not sure if he always has to be 100% fit to play to that level. I'm not sure that little niggles cost him games where you just think if he's prepared to play with a little niggle and just be that good on a regular basis, I think he needs to be 100%. Yeah. And that's when I've seen him be his devastating best.
To be fair, there are certain athletes who, if they even have a little niggle, they lose, you know, they don't just lose a couple percentage points. They're half as good. Sorry, James.
I think it's a very interesting point, Cass. I think, like you say, he's so explosively fast that, you know, if there's a slight kind of strain or anything there, he's literally going at such a pace. And he's such a, you know, and it, like you say, I think Pedro obviously mentioned about Ronaldo, it's a very good analogy to make, because they have kind of redefined the kind of way wide players are. You know, like 6'2", they're built like tanks. So, you know, you kind of get clipped going at that pace and at that size, even though it obviously stands you in a lot of good stead in a lot of ways. I think if you have got a strain there and anything, there are dangers there. I think the other thing, you mentioned about Rooney, though. You know, Rooney's not good when he's got a niggle. And Rooney, if Rooney's mind's not on it, if there's a slight distraction in his life or whatever, as we've seen, he can be terribly off his game. I mean, you know, we see him go in bursts and various things. I mean, Rooney's had these long kind of slumps in the past, a lot of which might be owing to a niggle here or there, or kind of problems with, you know, his mentality or whatever. So I don't think he's, you know, I don't think he's a kind of a great example of a player who will just play regardless. I think he can be quite affected if he's not 100%. I think Bale's maybe a little bit more different than that. I just think he's got that close control and sheer pace coupled with great vision and a scoring ability that just terrifies teams. I think when you kind of bring all those kind of attributes together, and a it's quite a rare commodity.
And a laid-back lad, you know, down-to-earth sort of guy. We all hear about him off the field.
Yeah. He's not a stereotype, James, a Giggs way. You know, he's so much bigger and bulky. It's like the new age kind of you know, Giggs, but with this ability that maybe Giggs didn't have in his earlier career to play in different positions and kind of more challenging. All over the place. I mean, he's had a great kind of couple of seasons. He obviously had that injury in Tottenham, missed him. You know, I'd still like to see how the next kind of 12 to 18 months go, but he's got terrific potential.
I'm going to wrap this up. I want to talk about how I think it's a complete disgrace and a freak show that in this country, and only in this country, there is a rule that or clubs are allowed to make stipulations when they loan players that they can't play against their parent club. I feel horrible for Spurs that Adebayor didn't start. He started every game since arriving at Tottenham. I think what you saw out there wasn't Tottenham, because this season's Tottenham has Adebayor up front. I think they're a different team. I think they're a better team with it. And yeah, I think Tottenham, you were screwed. You were screwed by some of the refereeing, but you were primarily screwed by this insane rule, which really shouldn't exist. And because Chris is telling me to move on, even if you guys disagree with me, there will be no disagreement. Not today, anyway. Let's move on to the Emirates. Last time around, it was 8-2. We expected different. I think we got different. But I want to start, before we get into United, I want to start with United. It struck me, they took the pitch. You know, people have talked about a few years ago when United made that comeback against Villa and Kiko Makeda scored the last winner, and how it, some people suggested it was sort of a turning point because they saw that they were good, and, you know, but also they kind of had sort of some luck and some happenstance on their side, and you kind of feel like, yeah, this is our year. They would have gone on the pitch knowing what happened at Eastlands, knowing that, ooh, this is a chance to pull closer. And then that incident at the end. In those circumstances, I think, to go and win and to create as many chances as they did, I thought that was a big show of character, James.
Yeah, I don't really think it's anything new. I mean, they do this. They've been doing this for, well, for much of Ferguson's reign, but certainly in the last couple of years, they're kind of, the show of characters kind of been remarkable. I just don't, I keep asking myself how they continue to keep winning with some of the, you know, with the teams that they have. Winning so prolifically, you know, a lot of the time. But I don't know if it was, I don't know if it's hugely pivotal. You know, it's January. I think, you know, when we get into March and April, I think we'll be much more key games then. I just think they had to win. It would have been a poor result not to have beaten Arsenal that day.
They created loads of chances. Danny Welbeck missed a bunch of the matches. I want to go to you, Cass, because obviously Welbeck's in a contract situation. From the outside, we like to find reasons why players we think are good miss chances. Look, is he thinking of his new contract? Does that come into you when you're on the pitch? Or is it just something you don't really think about?
Well, it shouldn't come into you when you're on the pitch thinking about...
Did it with you? Money, when all those times you were having big contract disputes because you wanted more money?
Well,
so you could buy more Bentleys?
It does play a part, but I don't honestly think I entered the pitch thinking, oh, if I score three today, I'll get that extra $2,000 I've asked for. No.
So you just missed those chances because he was on.
The bottom line is, Gap, is that when you're a player, I think if you're intelligent enough to think, if I play well and I score goals and I do it, I'll get what the game rate is. And I think Welbeck is no different. If he performs and shows what he can do, Ferguson will give him a contract that is worthy for where he is at his stage of his career.
Pedro, you create a bazillion chances at the Emirates. You only convert one. Then against the run of play, Van Persie equalizes. Then, you know, you go on to win the game. But do you worry when teams fluff chances in a game that they really ought to be winning? Or should you look on the bright side and say, look, they muddled Arsenal?
I have so many things to say about this game.
So do I, but I'm holding back.
I don't really know where to start.
We will be introducing the Arshavin Wenger Oxlade Chamberlain discussion in the latter part.
A lot to discuss apart from that.
Let's stick
apart
with you
from that.
For now.
Yeah. Okay, as far as the chances are concerned, United normally don't miss them, and I was worried in the second half when Arsenal were reacting that they were going to get a point. Not worried.
Worried because you're a big United fan.
No, not worried at all in that way. But worried that a team that is so much better as a unit would waste 2 points. Because I think the only mistake Ferguson made yesterday was not trying to freshen up midfield, because you could see in the second half that Arsenal were just getting faster and faster.
And he settled down a little bit.
A little bit, but
Park came on as well. Didn't
yeah, Park yeah. came on as well. But that was after Arsenal equalized, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I thought he should have made those changes maybe 10 minutes earlier. But again, I'm completely shocked that with a midfield of Carrick and Giggs, they can be still this good. as far as a couple of other quick points, Arsenal starting with four centre backs when they know they're going to face two of the fastest wingers in the Premier League, and I know they had injuries, but why then take off Giroud at half time?
He was terrible.
Yes, so then
so you would have started Nico Yannaris.
Well, at least you play someone who's a bit faster and who can keep up with Nani or who can keep up with Valencia. I mean, to start four centre backs in a game like that, there is just insane.
He's done it before.
He has,
he's
but
won
not,
games,
but not against top
choice,
but not against fast wingers. Yeah. That's just my opinion. And then the last point, this game, really, you have a look at some stats and it really didn't go like you would expect an Arsenal home match to go. They had less possession and they had 15 fouls against 6 for United, and they had more yellow cards. You get the feeling that if Wenger is going to continue to preach this philosophy, he at least has to live up to it, because he's not anymore.
No.
Outpassed by Swansea, less possession at home against United. You would at least hope they would get a bit more possession.
That's a good segue into our next topic, and it's Arsene Wenger. I think apart from the Inaris bit, which I think was still sort of going out on a limb, I mean, Giroud's done okay in other games. He was just awful on this occasion. I think maybe we can cautiously give him a pass on that. But what befuddled the crowd and what you know, led to a lot of acrimony at the Emirates was the decision to substitute Alex or Alec. It is Alec, isn't
Alec.
It? Alec. Oxlade-Chamberlain. Take him off. He supposedly had some kind of strain, had to come off for Andre Arshavin. Now, you're laughing. We had Gary Neville go on a tirade about this on television yesterday. I don't know if you saw that. Like, yeah. You know, it says, you know, go back to Russia, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the women here, are, you don't like it here, go away. James, it's very hard to have sympathy for Arshavin, right? Given that the guy has this stupid haircut, makes a lot of money, plays badly. When he does speak, he just talks about, or the few things we hear from him, because we rarely hear him speak. I don't even know if he speaks English. But, you know, is quotes that maybe he said makes in Russia, which then get, you know, go through the media treatment and come out at the other end, where it seems like the guy's in some kind of gilded cage over here.
I think most supporters can accept, you know, that if one of their players is having a tough time of it, you know, and going through just poor form, but he's still trying, that, you know, they'll hold their hands up. They might get frustrated. They'll still probably vent that frustration. But, you know, deep down, they'll understand it. I think the problem we've all arrived at with Arshavin is that he kind of trots onto the pitch in that pathetic, soft way of his with his gloves on.
Ooh, and he just, sorry, that's a hard northern they're talking about, for those who don't know.
Yeah. It's a real hard move to go. And I watch him, and I just think, you look to me like a player who would rather be anywhere else but on a football field.
That
and I think that translates itself quite clearly to everyone who watches him, most especially the Arsenal supporters. And they want players who you know, even in tough times, are going to give their all. And
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Arshavin to me just looks like he's almost accepted. He's not going to turn it around, and he's just kind of biding his time. And I just cannot believe he's still getting in. Even with all the injuries that that Wenger has, I still can't believe Arshavin is getting in the squad. I think his form and his attitude is that bad that he deserves just to be omitted, and they just need to cut the losses as quickly as they can.
The bottom line is to this: Arsene Wenger is a very, very poor tactician. On Saturday, I spoke about and talked about tactics. What would they be against Manchester United? And I thought this game was so predictable. If there was any evidence that Giroud couldn't play right back, did he not watch the game, Arsene Wenger, with Sinclair, with Swansea, who absolutely ran him ragged? Man United's tactic on Sunday were to get at the right back position. They played nearly every ball directly in that position. They
You're
saw
going
that
back
as a
to the Inaris argument.
No, I'm not. I'm going to develop this because Welbeck's had 4 1-on-1s against Mertesacker, one of the slowest defenders in the Premiership with the ball behind him. He gets 4 1-on-1s because what Welbeck has been told, just stay on the shoulder of Mertesacker, we will get you in at least 3 or 4 times during the game. The tactics of Arsenal were awful. They had no idea. Arsene Wenger has relied only on one thing, and it's been good players. by good players, send them on the pitch, we'll win games. That doesn't apply anymore. The tactics on Sunday were a non-avoid to me. They did not have a plan of any form to hurt United. It was all about sending players onto a football pitch and deliver. And no more. Tactically,
so you're saying
I look
now
at
that
Arsenal,
he has bad players, or
he's got lesser players. Yeah. Gab, they're not bad players. They're lesser players. Plus, players got injured. Everyone talks about the fullbacks. Oh, they're injured. They're injured. One final point: Man United didn't have Vidic and Ferdinand.
So what?
So what?
It's a different team. United, it's a different manager. Look, it's a different budget. It's a different.
Man, you
bugs me. Like, they don't have Vidic and Ferdinand. They've got Smalling. They've got Jones.
Arsenal not got second and third choice or players in every position? Well, you have to in the Premiership.
They do. Excuse me, but I really don't want to be the resident gooner here today because it feels kind of dirty.
But they're not good enough, Gab. You can name names, and I can tell you they're not good enough.
No, it's not that they're not good enough. It's that they're injured.
We're talking about a guy who's meant to be a genius. The guy who meant to be a genius is a very poor tactician on football. I'm sorry, I just can't see it.
When he had a lot of his success, he had the advantage of knowing the European scouting market and the French scouting market when they were world champions and European champions, and he basically bought winners. He bought a team. Ever since, he hasn't been able to develop players. As soon as players turn to adults, they see, I'm not going to win this guy, and they leave. I understand what you're saying about the injuries, and it plays a very important part. However, the lack of ability to adapt and to invent, to improvise, and to get the
look
best
at their
out
second
of the guys
team.
You have.
Remember, their second team was as good as nearly any first team in the Premiership. That wasn't far along.
I will mention Jack Wilshere, Abu Dhabi, and Mikel Arteta, right? Three people who weren't there. I mean, you know, we can go and throw this around and say it's down to the players. They also had a lot of absences, and they did go on a very good run. And that said, it's obvious Wenger made mistakes. Just to wrap this up, Wenger says it would be a disaster if they don't finish in the top four. I think he means it would be a disaster for him personally. I mean, I know it was sort of interpreted as, oh, it's a disaster for the club and Kroenke and this and that. But I read the whole quotes in context, and I thought he means it's going to be a disaster for him personally. And I'm wondering if maybe there's a bit of a light there or a positive spin on this. Doesn't mean that Wenger's taking responsibility, Ducker, because when he says it would be a disaster for him personally, he's saying, you know, in spite of Nasri and Sask and all this rubbish, I have the tools and I expect to finish fourth. And if I don't, it will be a disaster for me personally because it means I will have failed. I like it when managers grab their you-know-whats and take responsibility. I think too many managers don't do that. Can we maybe, we've been murdering Wenger, can we maybe give him a little bit of praise and a pat on the back for this one?
I didn't hear the interview. I don't know whether he meant it was a disaster personally for him or for the club. I think it would be, given Arsenal's present state, I think it would be a disaster in the sense that they'll probably do well to keep Van Persie if they fail to qualify for the Champions League. Any hopes of kind of really seriously remodeling the squad in the summer, if Wenger can bring himself to do that, would be hit by the lack of that kind of option. It's correct, isn't he? He's been in the Champions League every season since he joined the club. So that's like 14, 15 years or so. So it would be a personal disaster of sorts when you kind of look back at that kind of record, and that is impressive. Right. But I think the disaster would be for the... If disaster is the right word, but it would certainly be calamitous for the club. I think the stage of development that Tottenham are at now, that Arsenal are at now, I do think they need Champions League football.
In our debate this week, I'm going to ask you to look into your crystal balls. We've kind of taken it for granted that, except for when it comes to winning World Cups, the center of the footballing universe is in Europe. We've had hegemony of different times, of Spain, of England, of Italy, of Germany, of Holland. We kind of always assume that, you know, Europe is where it's at and the Champions League generates all this money and so on. But our producer, Chris Skinner, who's a forward thinker, he said, could there be a scenario where we're no longer the center of the footballing universe? And, of course, he cited, you know, money's being thrown at various leagues around the world. Obviously, India
South
had
America,
this...
America.
South America, yes, the Brazilian economy is booming. The U.S., MLS is, you know, moving along slowly, using this sort of crawl before we walk, walk before we run, run before we fly mentality. And they're still crawling and probably will be for a while at the rate they're going at, but there are positive signs there. Obviously, China with Nicolas Anelka going there, Dario Conca going there as well, a guy who's been overlooked in Europe, so nobody's ever heard of him, but he went for a lot of money and signed a huge contract, I think with a team called Evergrande. And obviously India, with this silly, you know, Premier Soccer League or Premier League Soccer, whatever, which is sort of like the IPL with older players. And Robert Pires is out there, Fabio Cannavaro, Robbie Fowler is going to go. And of course, big name managers like John Barnes and Colin Todd. Apologies. But the point being, can we envision this future? Ducker, you're in Manchester. You've got global view.
I think it would be quite presumptuous of us to think that Europe is just going to continue to be a dominant superpower. The world is obviously changing all the time, getting a lot smaller in so many ways. Who knows whether we'll have a dominant Chinese Super League or similar in South America or the US, who knows? But I certainly think there will be at least one of those countries kind of presiding over a pretty successful top flight in the years to come. And we'll probably, as the kind of nations develop and change, you know, become a lot more appealing to a lot more players. I mean, you obviously get at this stage a lot of players going over for a final payday at the end of their careers, but I do think that will start to change and will go over earlier in their careers in the future.
I think there are two markets where players will go. Middle East, especially with the World Cup there in 2022. A lot of players are already going there now before they turn 30. And China. And this is just a reflection of the world economy. And unfortunately, players these days will go wherever the money is. And if that trend continues, then it's very possible that there could be a huge league. And I'm saying in, 25, 30 years. I don't think it's going to happen overnight. But especially with the financial fair play in Europe, if that's not extended to other regions, if there's no salary cap introduced by FIFA, yeah, players will go where the money is.
Interesting one there, because I'm wondering, and maybe I'm opening Pandora's box here, but you mentioned, going to the Middle East. Obviously, one of the big issues is, apart from the fact that it's pretty dire in Dubai and Qatar and whatever in terms of the football, because those are tiny countries and great competition. If they could pull it off, people have talked about the European Super League, and I just came up with this 30 seconds ago, and so please, tell me if it's rubbish, but is it in some ways Asia ideally primed to skip the natural evolution of sort of organic growth of domestic leagues and move straight to an Asian Super League? In other words, you put enough money in it and you have, one team in Dubai, one team in Doha, a team in Shanghai, a team in Beijing, a team in Hong Kong or whatever. Could you not get enough wealthy people there to just open it on a grand scale, chuck a lot of money and give it a go immediately? Can you imagine the size of the TV market for starters? Mm.
Reacting to your idea, Gabriele, I think it's very possible that it could happen. Honestly, I think it's with the money that's there, it could happen. It depends on how the football develops. But Russia should be part of that, because Samuel Eto'o told me he gets calls from players every week asking how the standard of league there is, how the lifestyle is, because players will go where the money is.
Yeah, and I do think that players, because they have families and children, and what's happened is they go there at the latter stages of the career, obviously for a financial rewards. If they're going to go there earlier, it's going to be for lifestyle and a love to live there. I mean, over my career, so many times when I spoke to French players who wanted to come to England, 90% of the time, and it was a huge part of the demands for players, was to say, I want to go to London. I want to live in London. They wanted to go to capitals where they assumed it would be a nice place to live. And yet, I sort of think, well, why wouldn't you want to go to Liverpool or Manchester or, And players do care. They do, really do. But, of course, they care less when they're coming towards the end of their careers.
Well, Ducker, a global Asian or Pan Asian league based around big glitzy Asian capitals. Could it also be facilitated by the fact that if I'm Joe Asian billionaire, I could buy a Premier League club and that'd be pretty cool. But then I come here and I have to compete against Mansoor, and maybe the club I want to buy isn't up for sale. And do I really want to buy Aston Villa and just lose money for a long time? Whereas, you know, I can, you know, build FC Shanghai and build a stadium and name it after myself and start from scratch and sort of get in at the ground floor.
Like an American franchise.
I think a lot, so many sales of Premier League clubs, or purchases, sorry, of Premier League clubs in recent years, half of them seem to be vanity projects. So I think we would have to obviously be, what you're saying is appealing in a lot of sense, but I think we would have to be some kind of, you know, global recognition, you know, of what's going on over there. I don't think it would be palatable to a lot of investors if that it's just, you know, an Asian Super League and no one knows anything about it.
Well, sorry, Mr. Eurocentric. No one knows anything about it in Europe, but I presume people in Asia would know about it.
If you get good owners, I'm sure that they'd love the idea of it. But I'm talking about the owners that football clubs seem to attract. And a lot of them seem to just do it because it's a vanity project. I don't think they've got much care for anything really on it. And so, if you get an owner over there who does care genuinely about FC Shanghai or whatever it is, then brilliant. I think that'd be embraced. But I'm just personally, the kind of owners you're talking about, I'm just questioning a lot of their motives at the moment. Maybe that kind of move would breed a sea change in thinking, but I'm not entirely convinced about it.
Final point on this, Brazil, and to me, I mean, we've seen a whole bunch of top players go back to Brazil recently, although some of them don't stay very long. But I mean, this is a booming economy. It's a big country. They have the football history. They've got the infrastructure. They've got the fan base. The argument, funny enough, that maybe works against Brazilian teams, and I'm looking at you, Pedro, because you speak Portuguese and for no other reason, is that actually in Brazil, obviously you've got very big clubs, but it's a lot more diffuse. You don't have like a Real Madrid or a Barcelona in Brazil. You've got, you know, sort of 10, 12 regional clubs that are all very big, but they don't necessarily have that enormous spending power, despite the wealth sort of in aggregate terms. And so a lot of times they would rather spend money on Brazilian or Argentine players who are a lot cheaper, right?
The issue with the Brazilian league as well is they've changed format so often that you kind of lose the perspective of what the standings means. And you've seen, you know, historic clubs be relegated, and Palmeiras, Corinthians, you know. And I just think that
Fluminense,
exactly. The issue with Brazil is after the World Cup, if they continue to grow as an economy, it's possible. Right now, I think it hasn't happened because a lot of the players still see Brazil as a third world as far as organization is concerned, the stadiums is concerned, security is concerned. I mean, Roberto Carlos told me recently he left Brazil because he just couldn't take the fans anymore. He was being, and this is a legend, and at Corinthians, he had to leave because he had to get three or four security guys because fans were on his case every game before at home. I just think if they get their act together as a league, professional league, and have a standard and keep to it, why not in 5 years they can get a few European players? But it has to do with the mentality.
Interesting. So he's complaining about hiring three or four bodyguards. I kind of like the idea. In fact, if I could afford it, I get three or four. I'd love the idea of having a posse or just even having three or four friends would be nice.
Nobody's chasing you, are they?
Even if they're paying. I know. That's the thing.
You don't need them.
It would make me feel important. Time now for some quick hits. Liverpool slip up again. They're beaten 3-1 at Bolton. Cass, Dalglish was very hard on his players after the match. Is this calculated to get a reaction, or Has he really had enough? And should he also get some blame for bringing some of these crummy players to Anfield?
Well, he has to take responsibility for Liverpool being poor. He made some strange decisions. The bottom line is that Liverpool's performance was way below the expectation of players on a football field, being beaten by a team that's been so weak and so poor defensively in such a dramatic style. No, Dalglish and the team have to take all responsibility.
If he wasn't Dalglish, he would be looking at getting fired right now. He is not good enough as a tactician, as a coach.
Right. That's just mean from Pedro. I'm going to shut him up because he's being mean. Okay, that's enough anti-Liverpool talk on this podcast. Ravel Morrison is at loggerheads with Manchester United. Ducker, is he worth the fuss? And what is the problem with this kid? And gentle listeners, Ollie Kay wrote a great column about this a while back. It's a fascinating story.
I think they deemed him worth the fuss for a long time, but they're starting to arrive at the conclusion now that he's more trouble than he's worth. The problem, obviously, everyone knows he's off-field antics, but it seems like not turning up for training or just ignoring calls. And part of the problem as well is they've spent so much time sitting down with him and trying to give him advice, and it just goes in one ear and out the other, and I just don't think they feel they're going to get through to him.
I've only seen this guy twice, and both times on television, but they do say he was the greatest talent ever produced by United's Academy. So hopefully he can resurrect his career, whether at United or elsewhere. The good news to Chelsea is that they have increased the lead over the other fourth-place contenders by 1 point. The bad news is that they failed to score at Norwich. They're the first team to allow the Canaries to keep a clean sheet this season, which of course means that Fernando Torres is once again in the firing line. Pedro, you have a better sense of AVB than most of us. Is he really committed to Torres, or does he play him because, well, he really has no other choice?
I think he's committed to Torres because he's created a lot of goals, and he's now gone 11 league games without hitting the back of the net, and that's worrying. But he believes that the best is around the corner. Obviously, right now with Drogba gone, he doesn't have many other options. He finally realized that Lukaku plays for Chelsea, which is an interesting development. But he's sticking with him because he believes he's still got what it takes.
Well, watch this space. Rory Smith, of course, wrote an interesting piece last week suggesting that Daniel Sturridge is annoyed at being played in the wing and wants to play through the middle. So Sturridge would probably say that AVB does have another choice.
Well, Gab and Ped, this is one for the both of you. Huge story in Spanish press Sunday morning, a possibility of mutiny at Real Madrid. Do tell us more.
Well, the big thing about this is that the story appeared in the in Marca, which is obviously a newspaper that's very, very close to Real Madrid. So you wonder if somebody upstairs at Real approved this story. It tells of a blow-up between Sergio Ramos and Josep Mourinho following their defeat in the Copa del Rey, which Mourinho appeared to have a go at Iker Casillas. And, of course, he is Saint Iker Casillas. And Casillas didn't like that. So there's a lot of rumors swirling around the club. I think that this is a... possibly the toughest moment for Mourinho since he arrived at Real Madrid, despite being top of the league.
We mentioned that he was jeered at home at the Santiago Bernabeu, which is the first time ever. This is the toughest period at Real Madrid. He's been given every little power at the club, and a lot of players on the Spanish side don't appreciate that. They also feel that the Portuguese and Brazilian contingent always gets the benefit of the doubt, and a lot of the core players are overlooked. And I think this is his last season in Madrid, and I think he'll take over Manchester City next year.
That's all we've got time for this week. Now remember, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, your web chats. A bunch of us are on Twitter as well. I'm at Marcotti, and Pedro, you're at PedroCNN. So see, there you go. Pedro's happy to criticize Joey Barton for being on Twitter, but he does it himself. Cass, are you on Twitter as well?
No, I don't tweet for the obvious reasons. I keep my feelings to myself.
There you go. So please engage with us. We'd love to hear from you. Till next week. Bye-bye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.